we return, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with colleague Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, we've both been under the weather for about a week or 10 days.
Yes.
Battling a cold, a little bronchial bronchitis. And of course, we're doing radio programs and using our cough switches all the time.
Right.
And both of us, 2 or 3 days ago, finally got some antibiotics and got some relief.
And some prednisone, which is a really dangerous drug, but seems to work in this case.
Sometimes I guess you got to go with the heavy artillery. I don't know. Well, we'll find out because we discuss alternative treatments with a national expert on the subject. He's Michael Murray, a doctor of naturopathic medicine. He's written a book called What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and Your Doctor Doesn't Know. And he joins us from Chandler, Arizona. Welcome to you, Dr. Michael Murray.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So tell us exactly what a naturopathic physician is as opposed to an MD. So you're an ND.
Yes, yes. I'm a graduate. I've served on the faculty and board of trustees of Bastyr University in the Seattle area, where I received my degree in naturopathic medicine. I'm a licensed primary health care provider. I have full prescription rights to drugs, but I primarily rely on the use of diet, lifestyle modification, helping people change their attitude and their psychology, and the proper use of dietary supplements and herbal products than I do on prescription medicines. And my particular area of focus is on prevention of illness, and when illness does arise, focus on the underlying issues that are causing that disease rather than using drugs as biochemical band-aids.
So Bonnie and I should have been working on our immune systems earlier rather than relying on the heavy artillery.
Well, you know, an ounce of prevention is definitely worth more than a pound of a cure. For some situations, an ounce of prevention is worth about a ton of cure. And prevention's always the best approach. And most people, what they're dealing with in this day and age are conditions that largely owe their origin to diet, lifestyle, and attitude, mainly chronic degenerative diseases, diabetes, heart disease, depression. These are conditions that can respond very well to a natural approach.
But if things are going around and all your coworkers have the same symptoms, it's
well, you know, not necessarily. I mean, I've in the last 18 years, I travel extensively. I've got kids. I'm around people that are sick all the time. I've had one cold, and it lasted about a day and a half. So if we have a strong functioning immune system, it has to be a pretty hardy virus in order to really take hold. So, yeah, there are things that we can do to prevent the common cold and upper respiratory infection.
Of course, here in the radio business, we wind up sharing microphones and headsets, so it goes like wildfire.
You got a tough chore, absolutely. So, yeah, you got to take extra precautions.
So,
sure.
Doctor, what'd you do for your cold that only lasted a day and a half? That's unimaginable.
Yeah, prevention is the primary goal, and there's a lot that we can do with our daily routines. And, you know, I've been a health nut now for about 35 years, and I think that keeps me very, very healthy and keeps me focused. Whenever I feel a cold coming on, I've always been able to kind of reverse it in the last almost 20 years, and I use a special extract of echinacea that has been shown to be clinically proven to arrest a cold, and if a cold does develop, it does definitely speed up the elimination of that virus. Our immune system is really a sophisticated system, and it's an important component of the infection equation. The infection equation, there are two principal components: the virility of the infecting organism, how strong of an organism is it, and the second thing is how strong our immune system is. And these common cold viruses, they're really not that strong, and our immune system, if it's functioning in an efficient way, can prevent those. I mean, everyone is exposed to all these different flu bugs, but not everyone gets sick, and it comes down to a few factors. past exposure is one important factor, and also the relative strength of their immune system.
But isn't it true that the common cold has mutated and gotten much stronger over the years and much more resilient?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's true for certain certain viruses, but certainly definitely true for certain bacteria. But the common cold virus, these viruses are, you know, they're really not that they're not that strong.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Murray. He's the author of What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You. Excuse me, I have to cough a little bit. And Your Doctor Doesn't Know. Doctor, if I open the average medicine cabinet at someone's home, what's likely to be the over-the-counter drugs that you criticize?
Well, you know, probably the ones that I really have the biggest problems with are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. The arthritis medicines, not just aspirin, but you know the Advil, the Motrin, as well as the prescription forms like Celebrex. And these drugs are great examples to really contrast the difference between the drug approach and the natural approach. What we know about these drugs is they work in osteoarthritis, which is a major form of arthritis, by impairing the ability to manufacture compounds that cause pain and inflammation. Another effect of these drugs is that they actually impair the body's ability to manufacture cartilage components. So the use of these drugs in osteoarthritis is a classic example of suppressing the symptoms but actually promoting the progression of the disease process. In addition, these drugs have side effects. The newer drugs like Celebrex, Vioxx, and Bextra, more Americans have lost their lives taking these drugs as they were prescribed. We're not talking about overdose or getting the wrong drug, but just taking them as they were prescribed. These drugs have killed more Americans than we lost in the Vietnam War. Over 60,000 people died as a result of taking these drugs. And it's really it's irrational to be using these drugs in the first place. Why? Because they're not promoting a cure. They're simply suppressing the symptoms. In contrast, we can feed those cartilage cells nutrients. We can improve their function through natural measures, through lifestyle, through exercise, and through proper supplementation. Glucosamine sulfate has great clinical documentation. Other natural compounds as well have shown benefit by really helping address the underlying issue, which is the inability to manufacture sufficient quantities of cartilage. That's what leads to osteoarthritis, not a deficiency of Advil or aspirin or Celebrex.
Right. Are you putting those in the same category, though? Because Celebrex and Vioxx and the other one you mentioned have gotten a lot of notoriety for being very, very dangerous drugs, whereas Advil and the other
Motrin
and non-steroidal anti-inflammatories haven't gotten that kind of. Are you putting them in the same class, though?
Yeah, pretty much. If you look at the non-steroidals like aspirin and ibuprofen, those drugs kill about 7,000 Americans each year, and they're a major cause of intestinal bleeding and ulcers. And in addition, what I'm talking about is one side effect of these drugs that isn't really talked about is the fact that they actually lead to greater joint destruction. So what that means is that you dramatically increase the number of hip replacements, knee replacements, ankle replacements, and that carries with it not only significant cost but also significant risk. So, yeah, I think they're all misguided biochemical band-aids that are totally irrational. We have a tendency to think of modern pharmacy, modern drug therapy, as being just this, you know, it's just the most advanced treatment. But, you know, nature, I think, is still far more advanced, and I do believe that medical historians and historians in general in the future, they'll look back at the last 70 or so years and they will categorize this time as being the dark ages of pharmacy. What we think are really sophisticated medicines right now, I think they're going to be far surpassed by safer, more specific therapies that I believe will largely be derived from natural compounds or compounds that we make naturally in our own body.
Aren't there some risks, though, with supplements because they're not overseen or monitored by the FDA? And what about the drug interactions with supplements and prescribed medicine?
If we look at the number of deaths attributed to supplements in the last 20 years, there have been the highest reported, maybe 150, with the majority of these related to ephedrine and some contaminated Chinese herbs, 150 deaths. In contrast, in the last 20 years, using published data with over-the-counter and prescription drugs, prescription and over-the-counter drugs have killed over 2 million Americans. So there's a great disparity. So the risk is not with the dietary supplements. The risk is more so, dramatically more so, with the so-called approved FDA-approved medications. In general, the dietary supplements are extremely safe. There has not been any death reported in the last several years using a dietary supplement.
We're speaking with Michael Murray, a doctor of naturopathic medicine. He's written a book, What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and Your Doctor Doesn't Know. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. We need to take a short break, but let me give out the number first. It's 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or you can email your questions or comments to radio@WLRN.org. Let's take that break, and we'll be right back.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Michael Murray, and he's written What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and Your Doctor Doesn't Know. He's a doctor of naturopathic medicine. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. And, doctor, I just wanted to ask you, in the case of severe clinical depression, do you advocate for antidepressants in spite of the side effects?
No. No, that's against a growing a body of research that shows that these drugs are no more effective than a placebo, even in severe depression. I'm just the messenger here. This information is provided not only the book that we're talking about today, What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and Your Doctor Doesn't Know, but also in my updated third edition of the Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine. And the growing consensus by a wide number of experts is that these antidepressant drugs are no more effective in severe depression than a placebo. And
I've had family members say that some of those drugs saved their sanity and possibly their life.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like I said in the...
Or you think that was a placebo effect?
Yes, yes. When we look at the clinical studies, when we look at the double-blind, placebo-controlled studies, 90% of the benefits that are attributed to the antidepressant drugs are achieved in the placebo group. So the therapeutic advantage is very, very small. I'm just the messenger of this data, and references are provided from, you know, well-respected medical journals. And I just think that we've been led astray for a lot of common health conditions, and we have a whole generation of women, for example, who have been guinea pigs with these bisphosphonate drugs like Boniva, Fosamax, Actonel, and now the research is very clear: the longer a woman takes these drugs, the greater their risk for fracture. So.
So you're saying when a woman has crippling osteoporosis, the drugs she's being given are actually making her condition worse?
Yes, and this is well supported in the medical literature. A study published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine showed was that when they look at the benefits of these bisphosphonate drugs, they've really been overstated. And what they found is that the benefits are only seen, best case scenario, in the first 3 to 4 years of use. And when women start using these drugs for more than 5 years, what the data shows is that their risk for having a fracture is actually greater in the women that are on these bisphosphonate drugs than the group that's on the placebo. So, not a good way to prevent fractures being on these drugs on a long-term basis. And I would argue that I think there are better approaches with diet, lifestyle, and proper supplementation, even in the first 3 to 4 years of treatment. One of the problems with these drugs is that they do increase bone density, but bone quality is also determined by the amount of collagen in the bone. Collagen is to the bone what 2x4s are in the frame of our house. And what happens when you increase that bone density but you don't improve that framework of bone is that the bones become very brittle. And that's what they're discovering with these drugs, is that they promote brittle bones as well as producing other side effects. I don't think these bone building drugs like Fosamax, Actonel, and Boniva are going to be on the market for too much longer. They're just they have limited efficacy, and they have a growing documentation of tremendous risk of certain really serious side effects.
Dr. Michael Murray, before we go and take some telephone calls, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Yeah, I have a website, drmurray.com. It's either drmurray.com or just drmurray.com. And I have a free email newsletter that I put out every week. And if people want to sign up for that newsletter, I give them a free PDF version of a small book that I wrote called Stress, Anxiety, and Insomnia, What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and Your Doctor Doesn't Know. And that'll give them a taste of the information that we're talking about today. Give them something to think about before they take some of these medications.
And first caller, we've got Renee in Miami Lakes. Hi there.
Hi, guys. As usual, excellent program. I have a three-part question here for the doctor. My first
We're very short on time, Renee. How about starting with your top question and leave it at that?
Top one is that if you can give us a little bit of insight as of how the FDA actually approves drugs as compared to maybe a supplement, if they are FDA approved or not FDA approved. And
okay.
If it's a supplement versus just a raw food.
Yeah. Okay. First off, let's talk about. We have this illusion that because the FDA approves a drug, that means it's safe and effective, and we often find out that that's really not the case. The FDA approves drugs based upon recommendations from an expert panel. In most cases, that expert panel consists of doctors that are either employees of the drug company or are paid handsomely to do research by the drug companies. We can take a look at the examples of the Bextra and the Vioxx or Avandia. Avandia was a type 2 diabetes medication that was brought to market with great ballyhoo. The research initially looked phenomenal, but the drug companies controlled that research. They put on the expert panel experts that were going to rubber stamp the approval of this drug. This drug increased the risk of having a fatal heart attack in diabetics by 64% and was later found to contribute to 83,000 heart attacks in America since the drug was launched. And it's a prime example of what's wrong with our system, is that we have to have research done not by these clinical research organizations that are basically handing over their research to the drug companies so the drug companies can manipulate the data. We have to have real transparency with research. We have to make sure that these drugs are doing what they're supposed to do without producing any side effects. And I'm not against drug therapy. There are many drugs that I think are life-saving and are heroic and are definitely important for people to use. I don't want to throw the baby out with the wash, but when we look at some of these major classes of drugs, there are serious problems with them, and especially when we start looking at what people can do alternatively through diet and lifestyle alone. We can really prevent and, in many cases, reverse many of these health conditions, such as type 2 diabetes.
Let's take another caller. We are getting very short on time, so I ask a caller and the doctor to be please brief. Carol in Miami, hi.
Hi. I have lupus, and I am on prednisone, and it kind of scared me when Bonnie said, you know, a dangerous drug. I'm on 7 milligrams a day, and I also wanted to ask about vitamins, because I read a daily vitamin is good. No, a daily vitamin isn't good. If you could give me any insight, I would very appreciate it.
Okay. Lupus is an autoimmune disease characterized by the immune system actually attacking the body's own cell. There are a number of natural compounds that have been shown to be helpful in reducing that type of inflammation, fish oils especially. With lupus, I would also recommend primarily a vegetarian diet to reduce the production of inflammatory compounds. There's a chapter on lupus in my Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine. I would recommend taking a look at that. In regards to prednisone, for a long-term chronic autoimmune condition like lupus, you're probably going to have a hard time weaning completely off of it. I like to see the dosage get down to 5 milligrams or less per day, and I think just adding a good fish oil to your diet and then following some of those other dietary recommendations that I have in the Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine, you'll easily be able to do that. But you'll probably need to be on that low-dose prednisone for quite a long time.
In the book, you say to remove the salt shaker from the table and not even cook with it. Seems like kind of a bland existence.
Well, not
I don't think I can eat an egg without a little salt.
Yeah, yeah. I use a potassium chloride-based salt substitute that you really wouldn't be able to tell the difference in a blind taste test comparing it to sodium. But the potassium salts actually have a blood pressure lowering effect, and our body requires many times more potassium than sodium. So, yeah, there's ways to make food taste great without salt. I mean, we got a whole cornucopia of herbs and spices out there that are actually health promoting that can spice things up a bit.
Well, I'll be giving it a shot.
Give it a shot. Okay. It's good for you.
Well, thanks, Doctor. I agree with a lot of your things in theory, and I just hope they all work in practice.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's all about getting results, and our programs that we outline in the Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine in my other books, these are proven to produce the results that people are looking for.
Michael Murray, Doctor of Naturopathic Medicine. His latest book is What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and Your Doctor Doesn't Know. Thank you very much, Michael Murray.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Good luck to you. Get well.
Thank you.
Food and Dining up next. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. And my apologies to those callers. We couldn't get on the air in our previous segment. And Bonnie, what?
And the emailers.
And the emailer
also. Sorry.
Bonnie, Linda was listening to our segments and found out that we were both under the weather. So she came in. First thing she did was break out the Purell.
Armed with Purell.
Well, perhaps we can look ahead, say, 20 years or so at our food future. Will we be eating conventionally or perhaps more scientifically? Joining me now is chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. So where are you going with this today, Linda?
Well, I want to welcome you to the food frontier.
And we've got at least 4 feet between us, so you don't have anything to worry about.
Right.
Well, I hope that's enough. Well, what's in store? Are we going to have test tube meat, maybe lemon, basil, cherry, tomatoes, or blue bananas? Or here's one, stem cell hamburgers.
Mm.
Does this sound interesting, delicious, or what? So is this food in our future? Our guest has some thoughts on this. He's Josh Schoenwald, and his book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food. Let's welcome Josh. Hello, Josh.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Well, I don't know if it's great. We'll have to hear what he's going to make us eat.
I don't know about the stem cell.
Hamburgers? Well, and also, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any thoughts on food lab in our future? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. And we have email.
That's radio at WLRN.org.
Okay, also with us, our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker, and he's joining us by Skype. You can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Is there a future in wine, Fred?
So now you mean I've got to come up with a wine match for stem cell hamburgers?
We want stem cell wine?
That could be a toughie.
All right.
But we'll try.
I know you can handle it. Okay, Josh Schoenwald, your search for the next big thing in food, you talk about Frankenfood. So what is that?
Well, Frankenfood is the term that has been used to describe genetically engineered foods. You know, taking genes from unrelated species and pairing them, and that for the past 15 years has been described as Frankenfood.
As in Frankenstein.
As in Frankenstein. If you take a gene from a Arctic flounder and insert it into a tomato, that's the notion of Frankenfood, which has, you know, terrified many consumers.
Right, that's what we call GMOs, genetically modified food. So what happens if you take this fish and you put it in a tomato and you're allergic to fish? So, and you eat the tomato. I mean, what happens?
Well, one of the things that scientists have, intuitively, when people hear about the idea of mixing, unrelated species, they do have these Frankenfood notions. But, one person or one scientist made the comparison. If you take a carburetor from a Ferrari and you put it into a Chevy, it doesn't make that Chevy a Ferrari. Taking a single gene hasn't, in the cases that have been in the marketplace so far, shown any evidence of having an adverse health effect. And again, this is a hotly disputed subject, but when you look to the scientific consensus, it's as overwhelming as the science that suggests that, climate change is happening.
Based on real scientific research and into the possible side effects of these things, or are we just assuming they're okay?
No, this is based to, the hundreds of scientific papers by the peer-reviewed science community that have shown that, contrary to a lot of, initial fears about, what's happening and, this sense that it is creepy, I mean, the products that have been out there haven't shown any evidence of having any health effects.
So you have, Josh, you have a different attitude toward, we won't call them Frankenfoods, we'll call them genetically modified foods. What's your take on it? How is this going to help us?
Well, initially I started this book, and again, I wanted to point out, I didn't mention this, but the story actually, this whole book actually grew out of a Miami New Times article. I was a reporter there in 2005, and I became very interested in how new foods happen after learning about a fish that I think actually Linda's book on the cuisines of or the foods of the Keys mentions, cobia. Cobia has been described by aquaculturists as the next great fish, and
Josh, I have to say that when I read your book and I saw cobia and I said, well, what's the deal about cobia? We have it here.
Yeah, we've had that.
In Florida. It's not necessarily a big commercially grown fish, but we have it. But what you're saying is that this is the next salmon?
Well, this is, trace this back I'm a young reporter, 2006 in Miami, and I meet a aquaculture scientist at the University of Miami named Daniel Benetti. out on Virginia Key, and, you know, I had never heard of cobia, having grown up in Wisconsin. And he tells me that this fish that I'd never heard of is going to be as popular, as commonplace as salmon within 5 years. And he says this is not 99% certain that this is going to happen. This is 99.99%. Now, as you Floridians know, particularly folks in the Keys and sports fishermen, you know, cobia is not a new fish. You know, it's been served down there for years. But as an aquaculture species, as an industrial fish, it has a lot of qualities that lend itself to farming. You know, it grows incredibly fast, 6 times as fast as salmon. It adapts well to a cage. You know, some fish, like mahi-mahi, have, you know, are sort of like tigers, and they respond very adversely to captivity. Not the case with cobia. You know, it had been described as almost pet-like in the way that it adapted. So, long story short is, you know, they, many aquaculturists back that cobia was going to, you know, be the next big fish, sort of
okay.
like...
So let me ask you then, we'll go from fish to meat, and what's this thing with this test tube hamburger?
Well, the test tube hamburger, you know, again, my search was just was not initially focused on technology. You know, I wanted to see the myriad ways that food could change, whether it's the discovery of an heirloom variety of radicchio, whether it's, you know, finding a new, you know, obscure ethnic cuisine. But in the case when I started looking at the whole question of the future of meat, and, you know, this is perhaps my naivete, but I quickly discovered that when you're exploring the future of meat question, you're crossing paths very much with the future of Earth question. The tremendous weight that animal livestock farming has on the Earth, you know, just the amount of land and water used, the, you know, estimates, some estimates say, you know, 20% of the greenhouse gas emissions are from the animal livestock industry. So when I started exploring the question of what meat we might be eating, you know, I wanted to look for a sustainable source of animal protein. You know, some people say that kangaroos are actually a sustainable meat. There's a lot of people who are looking at rabbits. Now, ultimately, though, I did take a look at this lab in the Netherlands, which is focusing on the idea of taking a stem cell from cows, pigs, and chickens, and using that to grow meat. And this is an idea that has been around for, since actually Winston Churchill.
But let me ask you, has anybody tasted this? Has it actually happened? Are they growing meat in a test tube?
Well, I won't blow the narrative suspense of the book, but in fact, you know, at one point when I set out to go to Holland, I, you know, was very excited about having a stem cell chicken nugget. That didn't happen, but there is plans that one of the researchers in the Netherlands is going to debut a stem cell-derived hamburger sometime this fall.
So we could get meat with no birth, no eating, and no elimination.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the idea is very appealing to, you know, people for the ethical treatment of animals is one of the earliest and enthusiastic supporters of the idea. You know, the idea
so the idea is that you take the stem cell and just multiply it into a quarter pounder?
That's one part of the process. Yeah. Basically, it's a several steps to the process. One is, you know, getting a stem cell, growing it in a medium. Then once you get a sufficient amount, the other obvious challenge is texture. You know, getting the mouthfeel of a cow, chicken. And that is a huge engineering challenge.
How about flavor?
Flavor is also, you know, a huge part of, you know, creating the correct broth of fats and proteins.
Thank you. Before we go to break, let's take one call that's come in, and that's from Glenda in Big Pine Key. And go ahead, Glenda. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I, for one, am very worried about genetically modified and irradiated food. Once they genetically modify it by adding a different cell from something else to it, our bodies may not necessarily assimilate it in the same way. And the fact that they don't have to label these things, you know, that everybody's against labeling it, look at all these new cancers and all this stuff that we have and these new diseases. Cancer is almost like the polio used to be with the bad water. You know, we have a lot of, in fact, they do even more to the plants by genetically modifying the seeds so the fruit or the plant grows, but you can't use those seeds to grow your own.
Okay.
What kind of study has been done as far as what this food is doing to our bodies?
Okay, Glenda, that's a great question. We're going to take a break. We'll have to answer it on the
okay.
other side of our break. Thank you for your call. So my guest is Josh Schoenwald. We're talking about the future of food. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Josh Schoenwald. His book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food. And he's been giving us a peek at what types of food are in our future. Just before the break, Glenda was asking about how genetically modified foods were going to affect us. We only have time for a quick, short answer to that. Do you have one, Josh?
Well, first of all, I'd urge the caller to take a look at The Taste of Tomorrow. I began with much of her suspicions and wariness about genetically engineered foods.
Well, have there been any studies about this at all, or is that still unknown?
There have been hundreds of studies.
Yes.
About testing.
So did they sway you? Did they sway you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which way did they sway you?
They swayed me to come to the belief that there are good things that genetic engineering can do, and there are bad things, and that people should not be categorically opposed to GMOs.
There are
crops like vitamin A enhanced golden rice that could do a lot of good for the world. There are crops like herbicide tolerant Roundup Ready corn, which add more chemicals to the world. But as a blanket statement, there's no evidence that genetically engineering as a process is any different than conventional breeding.
Okay.
In terms of human health risk.
Right. And so I think that the answer to one of her questions was, we don't know. We don't know what we're eating because it doesn't have to be on the labels. We don't know about that. But let's go to dinner in minutes.
So we
can eat some real food at the moment. And in your book, Josh, you mentioned that some of the future's new ethnic style foods, maybe Indian food, will become the next Chinese food. And so I have an ethnic flavored Indian dinner in minutes. It's curry kissed chicken with carrots and rice.
Mm.
So, and these guys have got it in front of them, and I'm sorry, Josh, you're not here to
eat
it with us.
I don't get to have, can you teleport a sample here?
Well, maybe that's in the future of food. Who knows?
Well, edible paper. One chef is working on edible
colds.
Paper here in Chicago.
Okay. Well, there's a dusting of curry powder flavors this chicken. And also, there's no slicing and dicing for this meal. And it's great for this busy time of year. I use ready-to-eat shredded carrots, and I add them to the cooked rice once it's cooked, so the carrots are warmed through, but they're still nice and crisp. And here's a hint about curry powder. It's a blend of 15 different herbs, spices, and seeds, so it loses its flavor quickly. So if you've had some curry powder on your shelf for, let's say, 6 months or more, it's a good time for a new one.
I have some from about 1995, I think.
Yeah, probably. So I'm glad that you even thought to have it, Joe. That's great. Anyway, to make this dish, I take chicken tenders because they cook really quickly and they're nice and juicy. I toss it in the curry powder and I sauté it for about 2 or 3 minutes on a side. And then I take those out of the skillet, put a little apricot jam and a little cream in, and then I spoon that over the chicken. So how do you like that?
Very good.
Okay. And then you just cook the rice according to package instructions, add the shredded carrots, a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. By the way, I wanted to say, even with the cream, all of my Dinner in Minutes recipes fit the government guidelines for nutrition. And so that complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's @LGassenheimer. All right. So, Joe, you finished your lunch already?
Yes, indeed. I'm going back for more, too.
Uh-huh. Well, there isn't any more. So, Fred, sorry, you're not eating with us as well. What are we drinking?
Well, if there isn't any more, I guess I can't. Well, actually, the future of wine is pretty bright, and we're going to be seeing a lot of new varieties of grapes that are created through hybridization. It's not quite at the genetic level and that sort of thing. And the reason is that most of the wines that we drink today, the Chardonnays, the Merlots, and all that, come from a single 5,000-year-old species called Vitis vinifera. And because it's a single species, it is vulnerable to being decimated worldwide by a single pathogen. In fact, as recently as the 1990s, most of the vines in California had to be replanted after they were killed by a root louse called phylloxera. So for the past 150 years or more, growers have been responding to that by creating hybrid grapes, such as things you've probably never heard of, Baco Noir, Maréchal Foch, Sauval Blanc, and that sort of thing. And they're a little bit of an acquired taste to some people, but so far anyway, but they're quite popular in the northern U.S. states like New York and Minnesota and Michigan because they can withstand the 15 degree below zero winters that some of the other grapes can't. And, for example, Cornell University in New York has just released two new hybrid grapes that are actually so new they don't even have names yet, only numbers. And if you stick around in the future, these may be your favorite wines with those stem cell burgers. It's hard to say.
Perfect.
Second, over the coming century, and something else that will happen in wine is that China will compete with Bordeaux and California in the world wine market. It already makes more wine every year than Australia, and there's no reason they couldn't make good wine there because China lies well within the same geographical area from north latitude 32 to 52 where wine is grown in Europe and America. Now, so far, most Chinese wines aren't very popular in the West. They tend to be kind of tannic and not as ripe and fruity as Western wines, simply because that's the way the Chinese like them. But that taste could change, and that could catch on in other parts of the world, or they could change the way they make the wines. Already today, in the United States, right there in Miami, you can taste a Chinese wine called Great Wall Cabernet Sauvignon. And I've tried it. It actually goes pretty well with Kung Pao beef.
Oh, there you go.
Now, do you have time for another one, or shall I shut up?
Oh, Fred.
Fred, go ahead. We have about a minute.
Okay, real quick. Finally, online wine sales will skyrocket. Hmm. America today has more than 6,000 wineries, but because of industry consolidation, a small handful of them sell almost all of the wine. And this leaves the rest of the wineries, including hundreds of small family wineries that make superb wines, competing without all of the national distribution channels the big boys have. So the answer is sell your wine online. It may be the only thing that preserves wine in the variety in the wine that you drink.
Are the shipping costs prohibitive, though?
Very cheap wines are not practical to ship, but if you get a wine that's more than $20 a bottle, they give you discounts on it, and it is practical. Now, you can't do that in every state, but in Florida, you're allowed to receive wine from wineries.
Fred, we're almost out of time, and I was going to ask Josh if he had any interest in the wine of the future, if he'd done any research, but we're out of time, so we'll just have to read his wonderful book and know all about it. Josh Schoenwald. Schoenwald, is that how I say it, Josh?
Yeah, it is Josh Schoenwald. And I just wanted to add one final thing, Linda.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I know that genetic engineering is kind of like the abortion issue of the food world, and just that people have very strongly held views. It's just a small part of the book. You know, it's broadly a search for how food changes.
It is, and you talk about the salads and how our salads have changed and all, and it's really very, very interesting reading. His book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food, and it is great reading. Bonnie and Joseph and Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next week is our annual Kitchen Gadget Gift Program, one of my favorite. Lots of fun ideas. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Of course, we have author and book links, such as today's at the Topical Currents Facebook page, also free audio archives and downloads at our new website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's Ed Bell on the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with Dr. Marty McCary, author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. And today's calendar, on this day in 1832, 178 years ago, the birth of author Louisa May Alcott in Germantown, Pennsylvania. She wrote Little Women and its sequels. Also, on this day in 1959, 53 years ago, entertainer Bobby Darin wins two Grammys for Best New Artist and Record of the Year for, guess what, Mack the Knife. Darin died in 1973. Age 37. One more while we think of My Sweet Lord. On this day in 2001, 11 years ago, the death of George Harrison, lead guitarist and youngest of the Beatles, from cancer at age 58. Something. And we leave with this thought from George Harrison, whose first written song was Don't Bother Me. He grew up in a public housing project and went to school with Paul McCartney. Quote from Harrison, "The biggest break in my career was getting into the Beatles in 1962. The biggest break since then is getting out." DinnerInMinutes.com. This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman and Linda Gastenheimer. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 90.